You're listening to the Script Lab Podcast. I'm Shani Edwards. On today's podcast, I sit down with screenwriters Brian C. Brown and Elliot DiGiuseppe to talk about their first produced feature film, Lucy in the Sky. The writers talk about their previous script, a biopic about author Shel Silverstein that landed them on the blacklist and helped them get agents. But it was after turning in this script for Lucy that they found themselves in a face-to-face meeting with Reese Witherspoon. Also, I asked them what happened to the diaper. First, let's hear a clip.
You know how it is. You go up there, you see everything. The whole universe. And everything here looks so small. We're so small. And then you splash down, and what, you go to Applebee's, you know, Monday Night Football, clip your toenails. And all you can think about is,
when can I go back?
Yeah. Hi, Elliot and Brian.
Hi.
So I loved Lucy in the Sky. It really kind of blew my mind. To me, the story is sort of about this. You live on Earth and you have this sort of myopic understanding of the universe. Evolutionists say, you know, our brains are only slightly better than an ape. And, you know, would you trust an ape to understand the universe? And then she goes and sees sort of this proverbial God's view of the universe. And it's like her brain can't process it. Is mm-hmm. that kind of how you see the story?
Well, I think in a way that's a way we could see it. But I think for Brian and I, we realized in retrospect that in a lot of ways, the spec that we wrote, which was initially called Pale Blue Dot, was in a lot of ways about writing the spec itself. There are so many things that people can do in life that are really hard to understand. I think for Brian and I, the very fact that we're here talking to you on this podcast, the people back home, my mother, our friends from high school, we feel it would be hard to explain something like that to people. And for us, this is really a story about empathy. It is about the value of being able to tell somebody that you're going through something and have that person be able to say, I get it, and know that they mean it. I think a lot of people really kind of say that, and it's just sort of a token thing to say. The space aspect of it is definitely a part of it. I don't think we talk enough about what we put people through, but it's really more elemental than that.
Yeah, for us, the real jumping off point was talking about working at something your entire life, working to get to a point, working to get to outer space, a thing that so few people get to do, and you're toiling away, knowing fully well that just doing the work doesn't mean that you will actually, that doesn't mean that you will definitely get to that point. But what is it like to accomplish that thing and then be left with the rest of your life?
And you relate to that? Now you've had your film produced, something very few people get to experience.
It's been really, really weird. And I will say that I am so grateful that I've gotten to go through all of this with my best friend since I was 12, because aww, Elliot comes from the same place that I come from. And we had, you know, we know what life was like before this. And, you know, in all of these crazy situations from, you know, this press conference that we just left, I can always turn and look at Elliot and say, like, this is really happening. This is our lives now, right? And I know that there's somebody there that understands how crazy that is for me.
Well, obviously, Lucy is played by Natalie Portman, and she's fantastic. I have never seen anything that I didn't like from her. But you know who I want to talk about is the John Hamm character, Mark Goodwin. Mm-hmm. So I loved him so much and hated him too.
Yeah.
He's like 50% American hero, mm-hmm. 50% douchebag. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that character.
You know, the ratios might be a little different, but I think we understand what you're saying. I mean, I think when we were writing this, back when it didn't have a prayer of ever getting seen by anybody or made into anything, we were always thinking, this is a John Hamm role. John Hamm is almost quintessentially American. Square jaw. He looks like an Alex Ross painting, you know? And he manages to exude a certain confidence in almost all of his roles, even the ones in which he's vulnerable. And there are moments in this film in which he has to display vulnerability. He's perfect for it. He's amazing. And I think the character that he's asked to play is sort of a counterpoint to Lucy, right? You go up, you see the world, and all of a sudden you seem small, lost in it. In the case of Mark, he went up and saw the world and he looked down on it. He felt invincible. And there are a few actors out there as good as John Hamm at being able to sort of live this philosophy on screen.
Their relationship, it's every scene between him and Natalie is electric. So what was it like seeing them together for you guys?
It was wild. Like watching that scene in the back of the truck when they sort of sneak off to have lunch together. For so long, like that had been a scene that we just talked about in a booth at a taco restaurant. And so to see it come to life and just for it to feel so lived in and for it to feel something like very separate from us and like the words that we had written and to feel like it was actually happening. Like we're the last people who should like sort of be able to get lost in this movie, given that, you know, at some point it was just an idea that the two of us had. But it felt so real and so vulnerable for both of them. And it just really moved me. And I feel so lucky to have both of them involved in this project. And, you know, Mad Men is my favorite TV show ever. And it's still very strange to me that John Hamm just told us that he liked our work.
That's definitely surreal. I think, listen, the chemistry is obvious when you watch the movie, but I think it's the smaller moments that Brian and I like as well. There's a scene in the film that I think was one of the first things that we really wrote and talked about. It's a small moment, but I think Brian and I live for these small moments where they're in the cafeteria and John's character, Mark, comes with his two daughters and wants to show off another astronaut, wants to show that here is a person who's just like Dad, who is an amazing person that you can look up to. And there's a degree of reverence there. And also the kids are just interested in the brownie as well. I think like seeing just these normal moments, the connection comes through even then as well.
Tell me a little bit about your writing process. So how did you guys, you've been best friends since you're 12. Where did you grow up and how did you guys decide that you could write movies?
So we grew up in this town called Oviedo, Florida. It's a suburb of Orlando. It's the former celery capital of the world.
Amazing. Bet you hate celery.
I think I'm fine with it.
The thing about the celery is this was a title that was lost sometime around World War II, at least according to popular legend. And so when we grew up there, celery was this distant dream. The big crop in our town was sod. And I don't know if you've ever seen a sod field, but it's just a field, right? It's just lawn grass. And
But so there wasn't a ton for us to do there. And so Elliot and I started collaborating on like art together at a pretty early age, although I don't think we called it art or anybody else. I think they mostly called it getting into trouble. And we would put together, we were in an old man band where we dressed up as 80-year-olds and sang 80s songs the bookstore open mic nights.
Right, we were in our 80s and we did the 80s.
Yeah, and we got banned from the Borders because our guitar player couldn't make like the second show, and we'd said that he'd passed away, and we brought his ashes in an urn and said he wanted them spread in his favorite place, the history section, and then just dumped them on the floor.
Right afterwards, the guy who organized the Borders open mic night was a guy named Storm Crow, and he said, "You've made a real mockery of this," which I thought was debatable.
But so we were doing that. We were making movies on VHS tapes, and then putting like relevant messages at the end of them, like don't forget that prom is next week or follow the dress code. And we talked our school into thinking they were like commercials for the school announcements. And then everyone had to watch these little shorts that we made. And that was this like wild experience where it suddenly people were really reacting to them and loving them. And it felt like, oh, wait, we could maybe do this. And the idea that those crazy little shorts that we made, that we've gone from that to a Fox Searchlight movie starring Natalie Portman and John Hamm, I still can't wrap my head around it, but we felt like we always felt like we could do it all the way along, which seems crazy now.
Yeah, you know, just to echo what Brian had said, it's a real big step up from working on VHS and cutting things together on two VCRs to being here. But I think that's really the roots of it. And I think we really started, you know, we took a bit of a break. We both went to different colleges and we reconnected in Los Angeles a couple of years later. I had moved out here. Brian picked me up from the airport. We went to Cafe Jack in Koreatown, which is a Christmas and Titanic themed restaurant that everyone should go to. But the thing was, we had a lot of time on our hands and we kind of picked up where we left off and started writing right then and there, and ate too many fast food tacos at Del Taco, but it paid off.
Here's the thing, you guys sound hilarious. And now you wrote this drama. How did that come about?
All of these jokes come from a real place of pain. No, I think when the things that we made as kids were like, they were definitely coming from shorts that like teenagers make have to be comedies. Like they can't be dramas. But Elliot and I, our friendship doesn't just come from that. Like, you know, I had like trouble at home, and Elliot's house was like a safe place for me to walk when I got thrown out of the house. So we really do. I think we come from a position of, in all of our work, we feel like there's room for both. We like to write movies that are funny and sad. That's sort of the sweet spot for us, because we think that's what life is. And, you know, sometimes you miss, but sometimes when you get that, that's sort of exactly the tone that we want.
So there was a lot of chitter chatter online, and I thought it was quite silly, but I would be remiss if I didn't ask you, especially since you guys are so funny, why you didn't include the diaper.
The diaper. For all the diaper fetishists out there, we can discuss that. Well, I think, you know, this film started its life as a spec script, and I think when we were there writing it, that the diaper's on page one of our original draft. The diaper is sort of a critical thing. I think for us, it was something that could be easily sensationalized, right? If somebody shows up committing a crime and they're also wearing a diaper, it's really the only thing that you think about. But for us, it had always been the one thing that you know, made this character extremely interesting, right? This is a person who was good enough to go to space, and a year later, they were at a low point in their life. But they weren't just found with a diaper. They were found with tubing, specific amounts of cash, a BB gun, lengths of rope. The diaper fit into all of that because there wasn't time. You know, in the original story, it's about somebody driving from Houston to Orlando to beat a plane. Every second counted. When Brian and I saw the list of the things that were also confiscated, it all made sense to us. It almost, you know, we don't condone behavior like this, but it became understandable. And, you know, where the diaper went, who can say? We also think that it's a story that exists separate from it as well. She's more than a diaper.
Fair enough. I assume that the changing of the aspect ratio came from the director, Noah?
Yes.
Yeah, I just was curious about it because I just saw The Lighthouse and they also shrink the aspect ratio. What did you guys think of that as a tool, a storytelling tool?
Noah is a director with a real vision. Elliot and I have worked with him previously. I wrote on two television shows with Noah, and so you sort of know that Noah is going to bring something bold and sort of distinctly him to the project. And I think that the aspect ratio changes are a really fascinating way to sort of try and get at her feeling of how different her experiences in her everyday life are once she comes back from space, which is, you know, was always one of the jumping off points for us. So it was, I think, a really interesting choice for how to visualize that.
So you wrote this as a spec script, mm-hmm. and then what happened? How did it get made?
So we wrote it as a spec script. We'd written a script before this that was a Shel Silverstein biopic that was on the blacklist years ago. And when we wrote that, suddenly everybody wanted to meet with us. And so we were like, we got to make sure that when we go into those meetings, we are not just talking about the script that everyone has already read. Like, let's have the next thing. And the next thing was the script Pale Blue Dot that we've been talking about for a long time. So when we wrote it, we'd have like 75 breakfasts where we told executives around town that like this was what we were working on. And so it was like a very, because again, we're two kids from Central Florida who knew nobody who did this for a living, and it always seemed sort of like an impossible dream. So to sort of get to this point where we finished the script and there were people waiting for it, and our agents were like holding it back, like strategically, was this insane thing. And then it was so quick that like we wrote it, we sent it to our agents, and then we were getting called to meet with Reese Witherspoon at the Polo Lounge like 2 days later. I had to change travel plans. It was like this wild night. I remember like sitting in my car, like my beat up old car in front of the Polo Lounge, being sure that it was going to be towed by the time, like being too embarrassed to park it in valet.
I don't mean to interrupt your wonderful story, Brian, but I also parked a few blocks away and walked over to that hotel because I didn't want to deal with the valet.
And I remember just like getting there early and sitting in my car and listening to a wrestling podcast and being like, this, like, I'm going to walk in and they're going to say, oh, I'm sorry, there's been a big mistake. Like, you don't only have to leave the hotel and the Polo Lounge, you have to leave Los Angeles and go back to Florida. But we went in and Reese was like waiting for us, and like we had this, like we had a drink with her, and it was like very, she was very, very nice and very complimentary, but it still felt like this is crazy, and this experience will be something that we'll talk about forever. And when we left, our reps called and said like, oh yeah, she's going to do it. And our lives changed, and it's like 5 years later, we're still, I think, wrapping our heads around it.
You know, I keep playing it over in my head, you know, the fact that I was starving, but I didn't want to be shoving food into my mouth the whole time, so I just ordered the first thing I saw on the menu, which was a Moscow Mule, and then I was thinking, do I look like a drunk? And then I'm thinking, what a terrible drunk I must look like if I am just a Moscow Mule fiend. But she was incredibly giving, incredibly supportive. The way that she had connected with the material was extremely gratifying for us. And I think we actually really settled into a wonderful conversation. Her interest in it, her signing up, changed our lives. And, you know, I'm never going to forget that.
Was she ever going to play the role?
Yeah, originally Reese was going to play the lead in the movie. Scheduling with Big Little Lies season 2 got in the way of that, and we're very, very lucky that Natalie stepped in. But yeah, we were thrilled. We would be thrilled with either of them in the part.
Of course. So what advice do you have? A lot of my listeners are writing, you know, spec scripts, trying to get attention. What advice do you have for them?
I think the advice that I have for them is like, we wrote this movie and everything that we'd written previous, and I think post this, under the impression that nobody cared what we were writing. And so we had to accomplish one thing, and we had to write a story that would be the story that the two of us wanted to hear. Because if that was all that happened with it, is like we told each other a story, then it would be okay, because it was like an exciting and thrilling and like empathetic story that we liked hearing and telling. And my advice would just be to write from that place and to write all the time.
Yeah. That's a big aspect to it as well. I've been in Los Angeles 10 years now, and when I first came out here, I couldn't get arrested. You know, the only job I found was moving furniture for $75 for someone's assistant. So I filled a lot of the time with surfing. I thought this would be like something I could do here in California, and it was terrible. But the one thing I take away is that surfing is like sort of the great metaphor for everything, right? You're out there, you're waiting for a wave, and the wave comes, and it's about knowing what to do when an opportunity comes. Brian and I were compulsive writers. We're always writing. And for years we wrote in what felt like a vacuum. But there are opportunities out there for everybody. And I guess the advice I would say is always be prepared. Always be looking for something that could be an opportunity. And when that wave comes, try and write it as best you can.
Well, that's great advice. What are you doing next?
I just wrote on a television show called Briar Patch that is coming to the USA Network the beginning of 2020, which is an amazing time. I left from Toronto where we premiered this movie to go straight to Albuquerque to film the episode I wrote of that. And then we've got a bunch of things like in the works. I'm still unclear about how to talk about what we can and what we can't talk about.
Yeah, definitely something to sort of figure out. But, you know, we've been busy, and we hope that these things sort of see the light of day as they can. And, you know, we continue to, you know, work as much as we can, pick things up. You know, so many screenwriters out there, they can make a living writing things that never get made. And so we know how very lucky we are to have something that people can buy a ticket, go see, talk about afterwards, hate, love, everything in between. Most people don't have that opportunity, and we're so grateful for it to happen so early. So we're continuing to work, and hopefully this will be something that happens again for us.
I would love to see you two write a comedy together. I'm sure you've written them, but to, you know, see one actually on the big screen. Any chance of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we are really interested in a very broad scope of things, and you know, everything comes from like a character. We like character is a real important thing for us, and is a jumping off point. And I think that there's definitely a good chance of you seeing a comedy from us.
You know, Brian and I, we never want to feel pigeonholed. We don't want to be the biopic guys or the true crime guys. And so the things that we have been doing in the previous years is we wrote an animated feature. We wrote a horror film. We write things that are comedic in nature. I mean, we feel that our tone and our sensibility is sort of scalable across genres. And so we're grateful to have opportunities to write, but we also don't shut the door on anything. So, yeah, a comedy would be excellent.
Well, thank you so much, guys. I wish you the absolute best of luck with this movie. I want everybody to go see it. And thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. This was awesome.
Thank you.